Hey everybody, what's going on? Josh Wigler here with a Stranger Things Season 2 in Review podcast. We are talking about the full second season of Stranger Things today, which means Stranger Danger. Spoiler alert, if you have not watched Season 2 of Stranger Things, you want to hop out of here, like now would be a great idea, but we give you plenty of spoiler warning buffer in the podcast itself, or duffers as it were. So please watch Season 2 of Stranger Things before you listen to this podcast, unless you don't care about spoilers, in which case, listen, keep going, power through. That's totally fine. A little weird, but also okay. Before we get to the podcast proper, let's just take a quick minute to thank our sponsors over at TrueCar. Because guys, we got to talk about TrueCar for a second, because there's something about TrueCar that a lot of people don't know. Using TrueCar can help you buy a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Whether you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers discounts off the list price for used cars and a better buying experience through our TrueCar certified dealer network. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the newer used car that you want. TrueCar is going to show you what other people in your area paid for the same car that you're looking for. And now that you know what a fair price is, you can feel confident. Once you register, you'll see a real price on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before going to a dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. I assume it's not available in the Upside Down anywhere. Stranger Things Season 2 is over, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps, talking about the second and latest season of the Netflix spectacular, all in one shot here. Hello, everybody. I am Josh Wigler, and I am joined here by a man who hates demodogs even more than he hates spiders, I bet. Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you doing?
What are you going to say, Josh, about a season that has both demodogs and spiders? This is not great. Not great. It's certainly not my wheelhouse. Where are the demo cats, Josh? I'm a big fan of the demo cats. That's almost like Democrats. I don't know. We got to be careful with that.
I prefer the Democats as well, for sure, and I am not ashamed to say it. And I am also very, very nervous about talking about Demogorgons and cats in the same breath, given the fate of a certain character that does transpire at one point here in Season 2 of Stranger Things, which is very, very upsetting, very depressing. We'll get into all of that and more in just a little bit, but just our quick little preamble to say, this is a full-fledged spoiler podcast for everything that has happened in Stranger Things Season 2, which dropped in its entirety on October 27th. We are recording this podcast on Halloween. Happy Halloween, Antonio.
Happy Halloween, Josh. Is anything spooky happening around your house?
There's lots of spooky things happening. The Are You Afraid of the Dark theme song is stuck in my head for some reason. I have no idea why. I'm going off to see Hocus Pocus at a bar later tonight, so I've got great plans in store for my Halloween.
Nice. Enjoy those yabos.
I'm excited about it. I'm pretty pumped up. Thackeray Binks, we've got a date in our future. It's going to be exciting, but you guys have a Halloween-timed podcast about Stranger Things for your ears right now. But don't listen to this unless you've seen Season 2 of Stranger Things already. We're going to talk about everything. Every single thing that has happened in the 9 episodes of Season 2 of Stranger Things are fair game for this podcast. From this point forward, if you're looking for just like the quick review, it's Stranger Things. If you like the first season of Stranger Things, you're going to want to keep watching Stranger Things. So go and watch the second season, then come back here, and we will have so many spoilers to talk about with you. But no big, long, elaborate, spoiler-free section to this podcast, Antonio.
There's no point. I mean, people at this point, we podcasted last year, Josh, about Stranger Things Season 1. We did a similar setup, and then we're going into the spoiler territory and talking about what we liked about the show. And then it became a phenomenon. I remember I was talking to our friend Colin Stone about this. I remember I tweeted about Stranger Things, and I tweeted about specifically Dustin, Galen Matarazzo. Is that how you say it? 2 Z's, 1 R?
I believe that's right.
Yeah. I tweeted about him. It said new fave actor, and someone associated with his representation is Agent agency found the tweet and tagged him in it. Like, hey, look, people like your show. That was the halcyon days of no one knowing about Stranger Things and those kids not being a phenomenon on GMA and the Oscars and everything that they've since been involved with. I don't know if it was the Oscars or the Emmys, but either way, like, this is a big show now. So if you don't know what a Stranger Things is, I don't know where you've been hiding, but probably get out of here because we're just going to go right into it.
We're going to go right into it. If you want the episode by episode breakdown of Stranger Things, my suggestion to you is to go check out our good friends at the Jay and Jack podcast, jayandjack.com. Mike Bloom is joining those guys to recap every episode of Stranger Things season 2. You'll get a much more granular episode by episode focus from those guys. We're just talking about the whole thing broadly here. And without further ado, I think we're just going to hop right into it. Spoilers ahoy. This is plenty of preamble to get the heck out of here. If not, then you're having phone difficulties. Some sort of malfunction has occurred.
Oh, no, you might have to go down to the general store and buy a new phone.
Go to the Radio Shack and ask for Bob Newby.
Oh, superhero Bob Newby.
Bob Newby, superhero, R.I.P. because I can say that. I can say that. I can say that because we're in full-blown spoiler territory, and I have no problem telling you that justice for Bob must be served.
Justice for Bob. What is it about the names that begin and end with B on this show, Josh? If you have a name that begins with B and ends with B, you're in some hot water and probably need justice.
I would be very nervous for any new characters showing up in Stranger Things moving forward if they are introduced with a B as the first letter of their name. Though, knowing the Duffer Brothers and Sean Levy, one of the executive producers on this show as well, and their sensibilities, I wouldn't put it past them to introduce like 10 new characters all with the first name starting with a B, and all of them will survive. Just to completely throw us off the scent.
That would be unexpected, to say the least, but it certainly would throw us off. Why? I just feel so bad for Bob Newby, Josh. This is basically he's the grown-up version of these kids, and he gets greased with very little fanfare.
Well, there's lots of fanfare. It just also feels like there's probably lots that could have been done to avoid such an occasion to begin with. Anyway, we could talk about the Bob Newby as we go through this podcast, but I do think as we're just sort of starting to sketch out our thoughts on season 2 of Stranger Things, A, can you give me some setup as to what you were expecting from a second season of Stranger Things, and then let me know how it measured up to those expectations. I'd be really curious about both of those things.
Well, the coda, if you will, the ending of season 1 left me certainly thinking that a season 2 of Stranger Things would detail what was going on with Eleven. Where had she gone to? How had she ultimately dealt with whatever happened after she had her confrontation with the Demogorgon and blew herself up, evaporated herself, disappeared, did whatever she did? Why was Hopper leaving food for her in a specific spot in the forest? How was that going to come back into this story? And then also Will Byers. What was going on with Will when he seems to be okay, but he excuses himself from the table, goes to the bathroom, disgustingly vomits up some sort of slug that we now find out has a definite connection to the Upside Down and the Demogorgon. So I expected that to deal with those two stories head on. I wasn't sure how much of a time jump there would be. I think it makes sense that there was a time jump that we had because it loosely followed the time jump in time between the two seasons. So you could conceivably show why the actors might look a little older, why some time might have passed and things in that realm. So I wasn't let down by any of that. But I'm wondering from you, Josh, how did you feel about just first and foremost, what we've found out about where Eleven went and how she came back into the story? Were you satisfied when we did that flashback and we filled in that gap of where Eleven was at the end of season 1, why Hopper was putting food in the forest and how that all played out?
Yeah, so she, you know, season 1 ends with Eleven destroying the Demogorgon and potentially herself in the process, where they both kind of just vanish and you have no real idea of what's exactly happened to Eleven. That you get the sense that Hopper feels like she is out there because he's bringing Egos out into the middle of the wilderness, very knowingly, it would seem. And it turns out that Eleven, the same night that she destroyed the Demogorgon, just like slipped into the Upside Down for maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes, potentially, and then just like crawled right out of there and just zipped into the woods of Hawkins. She was only in the Upside Down for like 5 seconds. I mean, I guess I was whelmed You know, I wasn't, I was like really particularly just like completely whelmed by that development, that she was only in the Upside Down for like five, you know, really just like a handful of minutes, was barely there at all. Not even 11 minutes, Antonio.
Not even 11.
Before slipping away into the woods. I felt like there was maybe some missed opportunity with that.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things I feel like that was heavily teased in advance of the second season was we were going to learn a lot more about the Upside Down. We were going to find out a lot more about the details. I remember at the end of season one, we might have even talked about it on our podcast, the Duffer brothers, the creators, and really just the guys who run the show, were talking about how, oh, we had this whole thing planned out. We have the mythology of the show already plotted. We know where we're going with this. We know what we're going to say about why these things are happening, what the Upside Down is. We have all these pages and pages and pages of explanation of everything that's going to come out in the future seasons. And I don't feel like with Eleven's 11-minute trip to the Upside Down and coming out of it, and then really most of the things we got subsequent to that, I don't feel like we learned a lot more about the Upside Down. I just don't feel like, I think you're right, with Eleven going there after she disappeared, after disintegrating the Demogorgon and potentially herself, we could have had a lot more exploration in the Upside Down. Eleven really poking around in there trying to find out what was going on. A powered individual who could have looked out for herself and potentially lived in that realm. And I don't feel like we got as much of the mythology of the Upside Down as I thought we were going to get when they were promising that after season one in the aftermath. So I do think that that's a bit of a missed opportunity. On the other hand, the stuff with Will, I thought was one of the best things about the season. I thought that everything that happened with Will, especially the work that Noah Schnapp was doing as Will, and really being asked to do a possession storyline and a gradual possession storyline, so that episode by episode, he was a little bit more affected and more impacted. I think that's a lot of weight to put on that kid's shoulders, especially considering of the party, he was the one who was absent for most of season one. And I think he really carried a lot of that throughout this season. And I really thought that was a major strength of this season, seeing how Will was dealing with everything that was happening in the aftermath of what happened in season one. So I thought that was aces compared to what was happening with Eleven in those 11 minutes that she was in the Upside Down.
Yeah, Noah Schnapp, easily the MVP of season two of Stranger Things as Will Byers. I mean, he is just absolutely terrific. And he was tasked with doing some really intense physical work in the first season as well. You know, the whole moment where he is getting, where he has, you know, he's been implanted with the Demogorgon stuff, and Hopper's like beating it out of his chest and performing CPR and everything. Like, there were some gross things that Noah Schnapp had to endure in that first season, but it's really nothing compared to just how physical his job is in season two, when he's convulsing on the ground, when he's convulsing just standing up, you know, when he's really embodying this dark passenger that he's brought on board in the form of the Mind Flayer that is taking control over Will midway through the season. Just all of that work, the let me go, all of that, just the screaming. It's really amazing. Just the level of like physicality that was required to bring all of that to life, and that he was so clearly game to do it. It's really, really spectacular stuff. I think by far and away the best performance of season two, really not even close, to me. And I loved that story as well. And I loved that we got to see, you know, like Will and Mike getting to hang out as friends, and Mike's more sensitive side as he's being really protective of his friend that he knows is in really dire straits. I loved everything that was going on with that. To dial it back to 11, and to talk a little bit about the Upside Down and how it was or was not elaborated upon in this season, I think that that's a totally fair observation about season two of this show. Is, I guess we know that there is something, that the kids are calling a Mind Flayer that is out there and seems to be the king bad of the Upside Down, unless that's just one of many Mind Flayers that's in the Upside Down. But we don't really know. And I think that the Duffer brothers are not necessarily ever going to tell us what's really, really lurking out there in the Upside Down. And it was a suspicion I had even going into season two, that this is something that was probably always going to be somewhat at arm's reach, you know, at arm's length distance away from the true answers of what's going on in this shadow universe. But they've been pretty clear about it in the aftermath of season two, which doesn't, in my opinion, move the ball on clarity much further down the field. And the Duffer Brothers, I got to speak with them for the day job at THR. I've been covering Stranger Things over there. Shameless shout out to THR.com/Stranger Things if you want to read up on any of that. But I did ask them about the understanding of the Upside Down and how much of that we're ever going to find out, and if that's going to be endgame material or if that's something that we might find out as soon as season 3. And they were pretty clear in that, like, we have the whole thing written out. We have, like, our book of how the Upside Down works, but we might not even use all of that on the show because our understanding of the Upside Down will probably be in line with the kids' understanding of the Upside Down or the other humans in Hawkins and how far they will ever be able to fully understand what's going on in the Upside Down. So my feeling slash kind of concern about the universe of Stranger Things and this world that they're creating within the world of the show is that it's always going to be a little murky, and it might never have a truly satisfying answer to what it is and why it is and what it wants. And that's a little bit worrying for me. Does that worry you at all?
It worries me a little bit, but it only worries me as regards how I temper my expectations, because this is a love letter to 80s horror, 80s sci-fi, 80s films that include kids, adventures, things like that, and things like that. And ultimately, a lot of those, as they get into sequel territory, get less and less satisfying when it comes to the mythology of the thing. And you do get a lot of juice out of an orange that you squeeze for maybe one movie or two movies, and then it becomes less rewarding, and you don't so much focus on why Michael Myers is Michael Myers. You just focus on how he's going to wreak havoc this time around. And I do have some concerns that Stranger Things will get into that territory a little too much. The law of diminishing returns when it comes to 80s or horror or sci-fi sequels. And I think that this is a problem that certainly is not unique to Stranger Things within this genre, where the more you put on a table in this sort of realm, the more you get bogged down by your mythology, and the more you become having to answer a lot of questions that ultimately maybe you don't have the answers for. And maybe it's enough that it's a creature feature and you don't need a deep, detailed explanation of the origins of a thing. But I feel like Stranger Things is walking a little bit of a different tightrope. Maybe call it a flea and an acrobat on that tightrope, if
Ooh,
you will.
I like it. Yes, I will.
Yeah, because if you will, buyers. Because ultimately, they're doing a different thing. They're making a television series, and let's not forget how difficult this work must be. I mean, when we talk about these movies that they're paying these love letters to, or they're paying homage to, those movies came out one every 2 or 3 years. They're maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours long at most. You're talking with Stranger Things about 6.5-7 hours of TV when you talk about all the episodes in the season, and they're doing it once a year. That's an incredibly tight schedule and a very difficult turnaround on a thing like this. And I think their work is a lot more difficult than those things, which also struggled with this very real issue of the greater story. And I don't know. I don't know what the solution is for Stranger Things. I wish that I had the job where I could sit down and work on that with them. That's not my role. I'll just say that I my expectations have to be tempered a little bit, because I thought we'd pull back the curtain a little more, as I said, find out more about the Upside Down, find out more about who's paying for Hawkins and why. Is it about the Soviets, or is communism just a red herring? Like, what's really going on here? And I don't think that we're necessarily ever going to go there. And if they're saying that we're not really going to go there, then I just need to expect that each season is going to be an enjoyable creature feature. Call it what you will, but it's not going to be this deeper dive into the societal realms of who's paying for this and why is this happening, and what's the actual science behind it, and why did it start, and where did it go wrong? Who's at fault? Is Hawkins Labs a necessary evil? Are they keeping us protected? The nuance just seems to be lost in terms of let's not get killed by demodogs and let's run away from them and let's blow them up. And I'm okay with that as long as that's my expectation.
Well, I do wonder, you know, if the show is a little more interested in its own mythology than that would suggest. You know, I do think, like, the fact that it seems like Dr. Brenner is somewhere still out there in the universe, Matthew Modine's character.
Right.
That's a heavily suggested thing that comes deep into the season, you know, in the 7th episode of the season. So that's something that I feel like the Duffer Brothers and the people making this show are really interested in exploring, like, that level of the mythology of the show. Like, that is something that's being set up for a third season. And I don't know, your mileage may vary on whether or not, like, you're really holding out hope on a Dr. Brenner return, but I could take take it or leave it. It wasn't really something that would have been high on my bucket list even entering season two of like, will we find out what happened to Dr. Brenner? So I think like stuff like that and like the Hawkins Lab conspiracy, which is clearly heavily focused on in episode seven when Eleven goes to Chicago and meets Callie, meets Eight, and finds out that there are other people like her and that Eight has been going around killing people associated with those experiments, and that that you know one of these guys is connected still to Brenner. So there's still that conspiracy to unravel in future seasons of the show. And for me, like, I did not love that episode of this season. I did not feel like the, you know, the whole seventh chapter of season two was really worth the squeeze. I thought it was a momentum railroader for where we were in the season. It was such a jarring jump to go from having a Demodog jumping out of the pit in the middle of the Hawkins lab in the middle of like the tensest moment of the season to then like go completely into a totally different world for a full hour was really hard for me to stomach. But beyond that, like, the show seems really interested in that kind of stuff. I think in terms of like the actual dimension of whatever the upside down is and how Eleven is able to slip into like that shadow world between the two universes, I don't know that we'll ever get concrete explanations for like what those things are and how those things are possible. But I think in terms of like who's funding the research and who are the government agencies responsible for the experiments at the Hawkins lab and what is Brenner up to, like, that I feel like we will get answers on as the show moves forward. It's just, I think that maybe my opinion is the minority opinion. I'm totally cool with that if that's the case, but like, I care about that stuff less than I think the show cares about it.
Yeah, and I think that I care about it more than I think the show cares about it, which is interesting. I do think that you're right. We will get some answer as to what's happening with Brenner. That seems very clear. He's Eleven's antagonist at this point, and that's up there. But I also think that what's happening with Hawkins and the laboratory is interesting. We do have to note that Brenner didn't really know what was going on with the Upside Down. Part of what he was doing with Eleven and part of what caused the problem to begin with as he was pushing her into the beyond. He was pushing her into areas that he didn't know much about. And that's what opened the rift to begin with, right? Is sending her into those areas, putting her in these positions where they were really figuring out what she could glean from this exploration, whether she was in the sensory deprivation tank or otherwise. And it was that pushing beyond that great frontier of what knowledge they had that caused this incident to begin with. So I'm not sure that Hawkins even knows ultimately what the details are about the Upside Down. I'm not sure that the characters are interested in finding it out. But the problem that I have with it is it's always going to be there as a presence. The Mind Flayer is always going to be there looming over the season. If you defeat the Mind Flayer, does the Upside Down cease to exist? I'm not sure that we have any real indication of what's going on there. And my only criticism is that I expected more of that in season two. I'm not disappointed per se that we didn't get it, but I did expect that we would get more information about the Upside Down. And I'm basing that again only on what they said in the aftermath of season one about how they had plans for all of that. It just feels like they knew once season one went nuclear and they had a huge hit on their hands, they weren't just going to make two seasons of this show and be done. This is going to be a multiple season show. And perhaps the Netflix would want it to run for several seasons, 5, 6, 7. So maybe they needed to stretch that stuff out a bit, and the wear starts to show a little bit when you don't get any of that information. And we have Dr. Brenner as this big bad in season one, and he's this major character that has a presence throughout, and then in season two he's basically just off the board but for a couple of episodes. I think this is a very common thing with TV shows, for sure, when they're not sure how long they want to run and when they want to deal with certain elements of the story. But I think that became more prevalent as Stranger Things became a much, much bigger hit. They have to decide where they're going to shift some of these stories to, and this became more of just an action movie in the possession movie in the grand scheme of Stranger Things that didn't really go into great detail and only expanded the universe a little bit, which is totally fine. But you're right, the weirdest part of that is that in stretching its legs and expanding the universe and pulling back and showing us what the show would look like beyond Hawkins, we got what was probably the worst episode of the series, which is still a fine episode. It's still a 6 or a 7 out of 10. It's not a complete clunker. I think it is a complete clunker when it comes to, as you point out, the pacing, where it occurs in the story. It's just a total momentum killer. But I didn't think it was a terrible episode across the board. I think 11 is still a great character. I think the idea that there's an 8 out there, and maybe there's a 1 through 7, or there's a 9 or a 10, or who knows how many other people there are out there. I think the idea and seeing what that looks like in reality, and seeing what a darker version of 11 might look like, I think that there's some value in that. But I think it's interesting that when we did get into the pull the curtain back and look at the greater world episode of the series, it was arguably the worst episode of the series to date. Maybe, Josh, this just needs to stay in Hawkins and the kids deal with the same sort of story every year.
Yeah, that's why I'm concerned about the future of the show, is because I do think that, you know, Chapter 7 exists to blow up the world of Stranger Things, to show that there are Stranger Things happening outside of Hawkins. And the show's first major steps in that direction, to me, it was a big misfire. You know, for the momentum reasons mostly, but I also didn't love the episode. I think it's a little cheesy, like the whole running around and just like assassinating members of the Hawkins lab group kind of in this really cold way. Like it didn't really work for me. And I didn't love the gang of outcasts. Although what was the name of the one guy's like Funfetti or something like that? Funshine, I think is the name of one of them. I liked that guy.
Funfetti
would have worked as well.
Axel and Dottie, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like those characters were a bit of a miss for me. So I hope that that the Duffers have a little bit of pause as they're trying to figure out exactly how best to expand out in the future. I do think that they had a lot of really solid ideas for season two before season one even reached the light of day for people, before season one of Stranger Things became a phenomenon. I think they had strong ideas about where they wanted to push the story. And I wonder if they have as strong of ideas as to where to push the show in season three, or if they are allowing themselves a little bit of an opportunity to breathe and really think about where they want the show to go next. Really notably, season two of Stranger Things ends in such a way where you don't really have a clear sense of the future of the story. Season one ended in a way where there were a lot of little cliffhangers that needed to be resolved. Where is 11? Does Hopper know about 11? Why is Will barfing up these little slugs that seem to be from the Upside Down? How much of the Upside Down did he bring back with him? Is he going to go evil in season two? Like, all of those things are left hanging at the end of season one and are, you know, thoroughly explored in season two. Season two ends in a way where there isn't so much in the air. I mean, I guess the Mind Flayer is still in the air, you know, hanging over Hawkins' middle at the end of the episode, at the end of the season in the Upside Down. But can you think of any other like major cliffhangers that are really, really hanging out there in that same way as season one going into season two, for season two going into season three? Because I really can't. And I think that there is an intentional effort on the part of the people making the show. Like, let's just end season two in its own internal way, and then we'll pick up the ball in season three in whatever way makes the most sense for us. And if that's the case, if they don't have a really clear sense of where they're going with the next year of Stranger Things, I think that's probably a positive thing, that they could actually kind of gauge some reactions to how season two played out, where a lot of things work really, really, really well.
Yes, yeah.
Like Dustin and Steve, that's so great. Like, there are some character combinations here that are just like spectacular. Hopper and 11, that relationship is the king of the season. You know, everything that's going on with Noah Schnapp as Will, even though it seems like Will is free from the Mind Flayer's influence by the end of the season, there's just so many things that really worked incredibly well in season two. And I hope that those are the things that they are paying the most attention to as they're starting to carve out season three. And then looking at an episode like Chapter 7, which I think has been, you know, by most accounts that I have seen, most people are kind of out on that episode. Again, could be wrong on that. But I would love for them to really examine what they're trying to do in terms of like stepping outside of its own comfort zone and just think about what is the best way to do that. Because if it's a lot more like Chapter 7, that's going to be a really weird season of Stranger Things, and maybe not in a great way.
My hottest take, and I think I told you this, is I'd like to see season three be a lot more like Snowball at the end of the season. I want to see a John Hughes-esque high school, these kids going from middle school to high school or making transitions kind of thing, an adolescent teen movie. I want more of that and less of the sci-fi horror. I know that's not the show and they'll never do that, but I thought that was one of the strongest moments of the series, was the Snowball, the coda, if you will, after everything is put to bed and we see these kids in their transition phase. phase, in the growing up phase, and what that really looks like as they continue to age and as they continue to experience the sorts of things that are certainly prevalent throughout other 80s films. I think that there's an opportunity here to get more into that territory, because if you're saying the strength of the show was the relationships of these characters, I think you could put these characters in different scenarios and watch these relationships play out and do that. I don't think you could deviate significantly from the format, but you're right. There isn't a clear thing to pick up on. And I'd say what the clearest strong thing to pick up on is the relationships between the characters. So I'm interested to see what the show does with that. I'd say adding to the cliffhanger list, you're right. The fact that Dr. Brenner is out there is a cliffhanger, but it seems to be more of a personal cliffhanger. It doesn't seem to be the sort of cliffhanger that can drive a large amount of the story for Hawkins as a town at large and for all of the characters. It seems to be more of an Eleven has daddy issues and has to deal with Papa kind of thing. And maybe that will invoke Hopper to an extent, and there'll be some elements of that. But the reason I get into who's paying for Hawkins, what's their goal, the things that are going on there, is that's a way to drive the narrative a lot more in a third or fourth season of the show, that it goes beyond just Eleven has to deal with this person who terrorized her, and she has to come to grips with it, and she has to find a way to do that. If you're talking about the Upside Down, and if there's a true interest in going back to the Upside Down, there has to be some propulsive force that leads them back there. And I don't think we have someone who was left there. I don't think we have someone who is carrying things from the Upside Down with them. There's not a rift to the Upside Down currently open. So there has to be a desire that they go back there for some reason.
You know, Dustin did get sneezed upon in those in those Upside Down-y tunnels. As did Hopper, and we don't really know what like the full extent of the physical ramifications of that might be. He spent a lot of time down there.
That's true. And the Hawkins people are always wearing the hazmat suits. And I think in two seasons, we've seen Hopper spend a lot of time down there not in hazmat suits. And whether it was saving Will in season one, taking his mask off, putting it on Will, helping him breathe, doing all that, whether it's in season two, being trapped in those tunnels, he's spent a lot of time in places where the Hawkins people are always wearing hazmat suits, not wearing hazmat suits, as did all the kids. Now, the kids had the bandanas and stuff like that on, but you're right, Dustin did get sneezed. Don't you're breaking my heart, Josh, even thinking about that. But
well, what if he gets, you know, mind flayer powers, and so does Hopper, and now Dustin and Hopper are linked in like their ability to commune with the mind flayer, and they become kind of the Wills of season three? Don't tell me you're not on board for that.
Yeah, I guess that there would be reason to maybe need to open up. That would be a reason for Eleven to need to open up something and try to get into and get more information about what was causing the mind flare to have power, or what its weaknesses were. Because if Hopper is impacted, that's a big deal for her, right? Like, that is a personal vendetta or a personal issue that she'll have to confront. She may even have to go to Dr. Brenner, Josh, for help. Like, that might be a thing that happens in the show if Hopper is taken off the board. So there are certainly possibilities there, but you're right. They didn't lean into any of them. They didn't show Hopper coughing at the end of season one. They didn't show him at the end of season two. They didn't show Dustin like going away from the party into the bathroom and having a similar thing that happened with Will. We have no indication that that's something that's lingering with them in the months after they spent the time down there. So maybe it's something that lies dormant for a while and will awaken. We don't know, but that's a possibility for sure.
Do you have mind flayer theories? Is that the mind flayer? Is it a mind flayer? Are there many mind flayers? Or has the show just not given you enough information to even theorize?
And I don't know that I know enough about role-playing games either. Like, that's the other thing, is I don't know if Mind Flayer... I think with Demogorgon and Mind Flayer, they are pulling characters, right, from actual mythology of, what is it, D&D?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I don't know we'll have to, our great friend R. Philly, I'm sure, would know more about this, but there are probably real things going on with mind flayers in that universe, and real weaknesses and real sources. We get a very dime store version of it from Dustin as he's trying to explain it in the absolute worst or most basic layman's terms so that everyone in the room can understand it, and not having the easiest time of doing it even in those terms. But yeah, that, I don't know. Do you have some indication of that? I think this is the mind flare because it's looming over Hawkins, but there could be mind flares all across the United States for all I know.
Well, that's the one thing that I am thinking about, and one of the strengths of the season. And I think one of the strengths of Stranger Things overall, just something that they tend to do quite a bit, is they grow the threat in size incrementally. You know, season one is a Demogorgon, you know, just one monster from the Upside Down that they are fighting against. Season two is a ton of Demodogs and the Mind Flayer, but that happens kind of gradually, where you're really starting off with D'Artagnan as a tadpole, as a polywog, if you will, and you get to watch D'Artagnan slowly, actually kind of quickly start becoming a true Demodog, and therefore on its way to becoming a full-on Demogorgon at some point down the line, you assume. And then you learn that it's not just Dart. There is a lot more than Dart out there. There are a ton of Demodogs out there. And I think just that sort of like gradually pulling the curtain back and showing you that this is so much bigger than you realized, to then do that with like the Mind Flayer being this big, physically imposing enemy that is heavily focused on in season two, to pull the curtain back and then eventually realize that there are a bunch of those things that are lording over tons of different Upside Down hotspots across the world. Like, I feel like you can visually see that if you are trying to blow up the world of this show even further, that could be a really cool direction for the show to go. And rather than just being like, you know, essentially some crime spree in Chicago, like, you're now talking about like the Upside Down really having an impact over Earth at large, and not just Hawkins, Indiana, or not just some other city in America. You could really take it globally with the presence of a ton of different Mind Flayers. So nothing that's like really getting me to think that that's where it's going to go, other than I think structurally Stranger Things has been really interested in gradually increasing the level of the threat. And that would, to me, seem to be a natural next evolution of that idea.
Yeah, and I don't know if they're going with the straight one-to-one with D&D and the Underdark and the Upside Down. I don't know if the Mind Flayer is one-to-one with the Mind Flayer or whatever its name was in the D&D realm. But I do think that that is heavily influential. So I think if you were looking for possibilities for a season three, looking into that that IP, if you will, or that story, that the basis that forms the Dungeons & Dragons campaigns and the monster manuals and things like that, I think that ultimately that wouldn't be a bad place to look. It's certainly what the characters use for reference when they're trying to define their world, so it makes sense that the creators in the writer's room are probably using that for reference when they're trying to look at what the Upside Down looks like, what the Mind Flayer is, are there more of them. It's probably going to be more close to a one-to-one with that world than not. So I think that that's an interesting thing that I'm not as well-versed in, and I know you aren't either, but I think that those who are more well-versed in that can probably say, oh, I really think that season three is going to go into this realm. And really, I think there are probably signposts for some of that. I haven't read a ton of it, but my guess is that there's a little bit of signposting, or there's a little bit of an idea of where, if you want to look at season three like a campaign, they didn't play any D&D in this season, Josh.
That's right.
There was no D&D being played. So if you want to look at season three like a campaign or like a different story like that, I think that those with more knowledge of that realm and that basis could probably determine where we might go next. But I don't know. That's my thing, is I don't mind that we went beyond Hawkins. We went to Chicago, or I think it might have even been Pittsburgh.
We were at Pittsburgh at the start of the season.
At the beginning of the season, right. Yeah. Like, I don't mind that we're going to these other cities and seeing that there are these powered individuals out there. And I know that we have maybe up to 11 of them, or maybe more. Who knows? But I think the show has not done the best job of walking us into that. I think you're right. The show has done a great job of slowly expanding the lens of what's happening, but it's very slowly. That we don't really know what we might see out of a season three.
Yeah. Do you think that the Mind Flayer is fully purged from Will Byers, or do you think Will Byers still has any Upside Down shenanigans going on at the end of season two?
That's a good question. Zombie Boy. I don't know. To be honest, I've always looked at what was happening with Will as the sort of 80s panic metaphor that I was raised on about kidnapping or about child predators and things like that. I don't want to get too deep into that, but I always thought that there was at least a thematic connection there about, well, you have to be careful riding your bike alone at night. Even in a small town, there could be somebody out there looking to do harm to you. And if something happened to you, you might carry that around with you psychologically for a long time. And I think whether or not Will is actually physically carrying any issues around with him from what's happened, there's no way that Will Byers is not significantly psychologically impacted by everything that has happened to him. And I think there are ways to tell that story that don't involve him puking things up, getting possessed. I think that we started to lean into that a little bit at the beginning of this season when Paul Reiser's character was talking about, well, this is a guy who Dr. Owens was saying, this is a guy who, you know, you've got PTSD. This is coming up on a year. It's going to get more intense. It's in his mind. It's not a thing where it's a physical thing. Like, I think he was probably on the level when he was thinking about some of that. And I think that's always been under the surface of Stranger Things, not in the Upside Down, but just under the surface in terms of the 80s metaphors and the 80s stories that they're telling. That was a thing that was very prevalent in the 80s. That was when you needed to start looking at your Halloween candy. That's when your parents started worrying about kids when they didn't worry about them in the past, when they just started saying, ah, oh, they're wherever. They're out riding their bikes. It's fine. Like in the 80s, especially, parents started to take a lot more of an active role about worrying where their kids were at night or worrying where their kids were when they were alone, not letting them just go to the arcade by themselves at age 11 or 12. So I do think that that becomes a greater part of this story. And I think you can tell that story with Will, even if it's not physically impacting what he's doing in season three.
What do you think in terms of the future of the party? 11 is back in the mix by the end of season two. We know that a year from now, she will be able to be fully integrated into Hawkins, which is nice. That's great. Congratulations, yeah. Jane.
She's great socially, so that should be fun. Fantastic. That should go really well.
That'll be fantastic. Also, Max is officially part of the crew as well. It would seem that she and Lucas are an item. Finn Wolfhard tells a great story about how he is personally responsible for the kiss between Caleb McLaughlin and Sadie Sink, the actors who play Lucas and Max respectively. So that's very funny. What do you think the dynamics of this group will be like moving forward now that we have these two members of the party who are now newly integrated on a recurring basis, you assume? These kids are going through adolescence. They're getting into their adolescence. They're coupling off, Antonio. Like, are you excited about those human interactions moving forward in season three? Because I think that's probably my favorite thing to think about is, like, what will the party look like now that is like it is a full group of six? How awkward is that going to be for some of the members in this crew?
Yeah, lean into that, man. You don't have to tell the exact same story. I'm sure they won't. I'm sure they'll go with some element of something has happened to somebody in the town and the party has to reunite and can, you know, confront another issue and deal with more drama and somebody's going to die and whatever. I'm sure that's more in line with the story they're going to tell. But like I said earlier, that snowball scene made me think you could tell a totally different story with this cast at this point. It's so strong. The relationships are so good. They've got such a deep history at this point that you could really go in a different direction with this and tell more of the adolescent relationship teen story and not focus so much on the horror or sci-fi or action elements. I think they're probably going to do some sort of hybrid blend of that like they did with this season. But I'm excited for that. The thing is, I don't know that emo Mike or Punk 11 were my favorite things about the season. So I think that there are some drawbacks with that when you get into the real adolescent anger and angst and how that shows up in a season where there's also crazy amounts of action and a lot of forward motion and a story going on. I think you can get sidetracked or I think it can cause problems. But on the other hand, the fight between 11 and Hopper was one of the best things in the season. Like that, you're right. That relationship is so key. And that is all driven by just character, interpersonal drama between the two of them. Yes, it's about Eleven's history. Yes, it's about Hopper's history. But that all just feeds into an interpersonal drama between the two of them that has very little to do with demo dogs. And it has very little to do with what they're facing and what's going on. So that is something I think they could lean more heavily on, and I'd be okay with it. The flip side of that, though, Josh, I think is something that you're not as enamored with, and that's things like Jancy. I know you're not a fan of Jancy, and we got a lot of Jancy in this season, and if we're leaning into those relationships and those elements of the show more, it's going to come with things like that, and I'm sure you're not a fan.
I felt a little uncomfortable that we were supposed to be stoked about Jonathan and Nancy finally getting together while being encouraged to drink tons of vodka with a strange adult in his home in the first floor of his house, like
in his pajamas in his mechanic garage that he makeshift garage he lives in. Yeah,
played by Brett Gelman, who is so great at just playing so sleazy. You know, just in terms of his work as an actor, he just has that gear so readily available that like I couldn't read that scene when he, as Murray Bauman, is encouraging Jonathan and Nancy to just like seal the deal already. I could not read that scene in any way other than the fact that it was just like overwhelmingly wrong.
It was just hilarious. That wasn't my initial read. I thought it was funny. And then I texted with you about it, and I was like, wow, man, when I think about it the way he put it, yeah, drunk creep living in garage invites high school kids over to his house and gets him drunk and encourages them to have sex on his pull-out couch.
Like, it was creepy.
Yeah, put in the starkest terms, not a great look for the Stranger Things. But what about Jancy overall? Are you on board with Jancy? One of my good friends, Andrew Brenner, who is a big Stranger Things
fan.
Dr. Andrew Brenner is a big fan of all these things, and he did not like. He rewatched Stranger Things season one recently and said, you know what, Nancy shouldn't have taken Steve back. Like, I don't think she should have got with that creep Jonathan, but she shouldn't have taken Steve back. That he was literally laughing at these things, where like he had a lot to make up for. And I think that Andrew was probably proven a little correct that the Nancy and Steve thing maybe didn't work out as well as it could have. But Jancy, is that really something you want to see on the show, Josh?
I mean, I don't want to, you know, pile on to Charlie Heaton anymore.
He's had a bad week.
He doesn't need any added stress. I didn't really work for me. I was as surprised as anybody, the Nancy and Steve pairing at the end of season one, that is still enduring. But I really liked them when they were still together in the beginning of this season. I mean, I just loved Joe Keery as Steve Harrington, period, this year. I thought he was so spectacular all year long. And I guess without that breakup, you don't get Steve going on, like, the babysitter's journey,
yes,
you know,
adventures in babysitting, right?
Which is really, it's a really fun look for that character. I do wonder more than anything, like, what is his real earned organic place in the show moving forward, especially with the fact that he's supposedly going off to college after this year in high school. So is he even going to be around anymore? So I wonder how that's going to play. I bet like he comes back from, you know, these things are always around Thanksgiving. He can come home from college for the break. There could be some fun stuff to play with there. But in terms of Jonathan and Nancy specifically, yeah, I guess I just didn't really feel it. And I didn't love the whole Justice for Barb storyline. I thought it really felt like that was the kind of thing. And like, this is contradictory of something I said earlier of like hearing what people really responded to in season one and then leaning into that in a way that it really didn't need to do. Like, I do think it's important for a show to pay attention to the feedback that it's getting and to, you know, take that into consideration and maybe pivot in certain directions accordingly. But this is like a hard pivot into something that was really just a meme, an Emmy nominated meme, but a meme nonetheless, was the Justice for Barb thing. And I felt like it just took us in a direction in the story that wasn't fully necessary. It ultimately leads to the shuttering of the Hawkins lab, which was not always a great place and certainly populated by a bunch of pretty bad people, Paul Reiser notwithstanding. But they were also the last bastion between our world and the Upside Down, and Eleven is able to destroy the portal. But like, is that a forever fix for the rift in Hawkins? You gotta assume it's not. So in getting justice for Barb, they shut down Hawkins lab and potentially expose everybody in Hawkins to unspeakable amounts of unprepared, defenseless horror in the future of this show. So I don't think that they accomplished anything in a great way by the end of their storyline. And I just feel like it wasn't, I don't know, the chemistry wasn't all together there. The way that they get together made me feel so creeped out, so icked out by all of that, that I can't.
Blair.
Blair, indeed. I'm not the biggest Jancy fan on the planet, I do have to admit.
Yeah, but you're right. I do think that the Justice for Barb thing is an interesting, it's the law of good intentions, right? It's they were trying to do the right thing by Barb's parents. They were trying to do the right thing by Barb. And I'm talking about in the context of the story. And it probably is going to be something that they might regret or that might have caused a greater problem. And I'm not sure it's really justice. Yeah, Barb's parents found out that she's dead, but they didn't really find out why or how. And nobody had to really pay the the fiddler on that one. I mean, we see the military driving away, and hilariously Brett Gelman posted up with PBR flipping them off, but we didn't ultimately see the personal impact of that. Like, Paul Reiser seems to be without a job. He's not wearing his doctor gear when he gives Hopper the birth certificate, but he's still connected. He's still in the town. So I don't know who suffered the personal brunt of what happened with Hawkins, if anyone did. So was there really justice? Did anyone really get punished for what happened? I don't know that that's true. And I think that the people that ultimately are going to get punished without Hawkins Labs are the people in Hawkins. So I think that's a difficult thing that season three can confront for sure. And I do think, Josh, we joked earlier, I said there wasn't much ado or much fanfare about what happened with Bob Newby. But I don't know. I think we have a new justice campaign that
justice for Bob.
Justice for Bob that we might need to start here, because here's a character who was a great, I mean, Sean Astin is great. He's when you cast Sean Astin in a role like this, whether you mean it to or not, what he's bringing to this role is buckets and buckets of humanity. He's just bringing Samwise to the table. Like, this is who this guy is at this point. It's been his way that way his whole career. When he was Mikey in the Goonies or whatever, I can't remember what that character's name was. I think it was Mikey.
Yeah, but,
it was
Mikey. Yeah.
I mean, he's always been this lovable. He had asthma in that movie. He's like just the everyman who is a kid and grows up into being the adult everyman. And he certainly was that in this film, and he was a lot more. He had his moments where he got to really be good at what he was doing. But then, Josh, he was sort of a dink. He forgot his gun.
Yeah.
When he sees Joyce in the hall, oh, I got to stop now. I can't escape anymore. And he just gets this brutal death. And I don't know. I feel like the character was not given as much of a love note, even though we got Will's superhero drawing on the refrigerator, that I think he should have been given.
The Duffer Brothers spoke with me about the death of Bob and talked about how Bob really survived a lot longer than he was originally intended to survive. Sean Astin was also not the actor that they wrote this character with in mind. I think he just delivered an incredible audition and they're like, yeah, we got to bring in Sean Astin. That's going to be great. And then I think that they fell in love with the character through his performance. And so they talked about how we kept pushing and pushing the death until we couldn't push it any further. And we've gotten to episode 8 and narratively, we still have to do it. But in describing the character of Bob, Matt Duffer, co-creator of Stranger Things, said to me, Bob wasn't designed to be the likable character who perishes. He was designed to be kind of just an out-of-it dork. And I feel, Antonio, that really shows. That shows on the show that I feel like he's not written with a lot of respect. He is written to be the guy that just, like, leaves a gun behind. He's written to be the guy who, as he's being chased down by the Demodogs, but has a door between himself and the Demodog that's been chasing him, he has this overwhelming need to just stop in his tracks and be completely, once again, awestruck and dumbfounded by the fact that he gets to date Joyce Byers, a girl he went to high school with and, you know, lived a completely opposite life from. And that's so endearing and that's so cute and all, but, like, it also just does the character no service in a final moment like that. This guy who has just, basicked his way out of, you know, saving everybody inside of the Hawkins lab, all the people he cares about, doing, like, all of this, like, computer maneuvering that would make Lexi from Jurassic Park very jealous. I feel like the fact that, like, we're showing that that really great side of this character, and then he's just, like, dumped off like a total dork, was disappointing for sure. It didn't feel like an earned way to kill this character off, and it aggravates me just a little bit, like, understanding the way that the creators viewed the character as well, and just, like, not liking your own character so much and having such little respect for your own character that you basically, without saying it, like, the reason why he's leaving his gun behind is because he's just an out of it dink, which is kind of lame. I think that's kind of lame.
Well, and there, you're presented with, you let him be a little bit of a hero with the basic thing, right? And you let him have these hero moments and you call him a superhero, but then he doesn't really die a hero's death. He dies a moron's death. And that's the downside to it. You've got a lot of opportunity to have him sacrifice himself or have him give his life to save Will or to save Joyce or to save a character like that. And instead, he's just killed because he thinks his girlfriend is pretty. And that's pretty lame. So I don't know. At the end of the day, I loved having Bob in the cast. I like the character. I like the role. I like the connections he was making with Will, even though he gave him, Josh, some pretty terrible advice.
Horrible advice. Go away, Mr. Bolo.
Yes. Oh, by the way, yeah, Bob is from Maine, and he has dreams about a clown invading his bedrooms. Like, is that on purpose? I don't think it's on accident.
It's not an accident.
He's got the id connections. Yeah. So, but did you think that there was ever a time where we could have thought that Bob was, that he had more nefarious reasons, like that he might have been a Hawkins lab plant, that he might have been so smart and so connected, and that he was the nerd in high school, that he perhaps ascended to some higher ranking job at Hawkins, and he was placed in the, in this role to work the Byers family and to find out more about what was happening with Will and to direct him in a certain direction. I thought that's where they were going with the story 3 or 4 episodes in, for sure, especially when he gave him that really bad advice.
I thought so too. I'm glad they didn't go in that direction. I think that that would have been a little trite for me, and just a little expected. It felt like that was the way they were going, and I'm totally fine with instead using Bob to be kind of like the big heartbreaker of the season. If you make that death like really work, like if you really organize that and create that scene in a way that just logistically makes more sense, like for him to have been running away from the Demodog and shut the door and then just like take a moment to catch his breath and fawn over Winona Ryder is just ridiculous to me. Like, yeah. That makes no sense. I have no problem with him getting killed off and that having a huge emotional impact on everybody. And I think I prefer that to any, you know, sort of like he's the mole type of situation.
You love moles, too.
I do. That's, love moles. I do. I am a fan. But I think it wouldn't have really worked with that character for me. Kind of along those same lines,
though. I was going to ask you, talk about this. Talk about him.
The Paul Reiser character as Dr. Owens. And you're really expecting all season long because of the baggage with Hawkins Lab, that the guy who is now in charge of Hawkins Lab is probably going to be a slime ball as well. There is the added effect that Paul Reiser, outside of Mad About You, is got to be most famous for his role in Aliens as Burke Carter J, who is the company man who is going to get reamed out by Ripley at multiple points in Aliens because he is not on the level, despite appearances to the contrary. So he's just sort of this like famous weasel in science fiction lore. And to bring that guy in to season two, to bring Paul Reiser in to kind of play yet another quote unquote company man in a season that is really evoking Aliens for better and for worse, in my opinion, this is one way where it's really leaning on those expectations and I think subverting them in a cool and clever way. Like, I really love that ultimately Dr. Owens is like the nice doctor who talks to you about your desert island candy and, like, you know, is like giving you a lollipop at the end of your supernatural checkup. Like, I think he's a really great character. I think that he's a great addition to the Stranger Things universe, and I hope that they lean on him more for season three and that he wasn't just a one-off player in season two. But if he is just a one-off player in season two, I thought that was a great way of paying homage to a movie that clearly means a lot to the Duffer brothers, and to do it in a way that brings us a really great, unexpected character who is linked in to these, you know, crazier sides and the more conspiratorial sides of the storyline, but with a good heart on top of it, and, you know, portrayed by an actor who typically, when you think about him in this context at least, really represented the exact opposite end of the emotional spectrum. I thought that that was really great. I thought it was a great use of Paul Reiser in this season.
Yeah, and just getting back to what we were talking about before, I think, first of all, you're 100% correct about that. But secondly, it's, he provides the opportunity to look at Hawkins in a different light, because given the opportunity to kill Will in terms of burning the what's spreading with the Mind Flayer and all of the vines or whatever you want to call those things, he's not doing it because he doesn't want to harm Will. It's a complication, he calls it, and it's something that they become very interested in monitoring, and they're not going to sacrifice, from an ethical perspective, they're not going to sacrifice one kid's life for the lives of everyone. They're not going to do that, and that's a very different Hawkins Labs, I think, than we thought about Hawkins Labs in season one. And if Hawkins Labs can have a guy like Dr. Brenner but also have a guy like Dr. Owens, what is Hawkins Labs, really? Like, what is the basis of what they're doing? Because the other thing that's going on in the background, and another set of new characters that were introduced, we saw, and this, I'm connecting the two in my own mind, not in the actual story, but we saw what was happening with the poor Wheeler family, the goofy Wheeler family, whether it's Nancy or Ted, who is carrying trotting the patriotic company line, where they've been asked by the government to not say anything. And we see Eleven as she emerges from the upside down, witnessing addressing the direct aftermath of what happened in season one. And we see random government agents in suit coats or in these trench coats telling the Wheeler family, like, no, you're not, this is the company line. You can't say anything. You got to do this. You got to say that. You didn't know anything. And, oh, I'm saluting you, basically. I'm a patriot. And the show gets a lot of mileage out of the election signs and showing where people's visions of the country that they live in are with regard to where they are in Hawkins. And we see the Wheeler family with their Reagan Bush sign and their patriotic nature. They're not going to break the company line on what they witnessed. Nobody's going to talk about 11. Nobody's going to mention that she was around. Nobody's going to mention that she existed, lest the Russians find out, Josh. We don't want the Russians involved. And that specter of what's happening is held over this whole town. And that's a big part of what the background and the view of Hawkins Labs is. We don't really see that with Dr. Owens at all. He's a very different guy. And so I think that only that Paul Reiser's role in the story only serves to cement what you're saying about how maybe the Justice for Barb thing and shutting down Hawkins Labs is a lot more bitter than sweet when it ultimately is going to be revealed in season three what a Hawkins without Hawkins Labs looks like. Even though Hawkins Labs might have been the ones that brought the problems to town, you probably need them to deal with what's happening now. And the flip side of that, when I say that there's another group of characters, I'm not sure that I'm just saying that I didn't like at all. I liked the character of Max, and the Hargrove family was not something that was as good for me. Max was great, but Billy, not great. And when we pulled the curtain back,
How dare you say yes. No to Dacre Montgomery as
I say no.
Billy Hargrove.
I say strong no. That's terrible, terrible, terrible. I hated every second, except for maybe when Billy was talking to Nancy Wheeler, which was hilarious.
You do have to tip your cap or your mulleted wig at least to the fact that, like, that was a deeply dedicated performance.
Yeah, he went all in.
When you put
that wig on, yeah, you really have to commit yourself to the role. Smoking cigarettes while pumping iron and just keg standing. But I thought that Max and Billy there was a lot of mystery in their story initially. Like, well, we're not family, but we're going to be forced to work together. We're going to be forced to be, and we came from California. And what is their role? Mad Max, this crazy character brought in. That's the mystery of the beginning of the season. I thought there's a chance that we were going to see Josh, Philip and Elizabeth type scenario from The Americans, where these were going to be like Paige, where these were going to be operatives tasked with getting information about the party. And when Lucas spilled his guts to Max and told her everything about what had happened, I thought, oh, you just made a huge mistake, buddy. She's a Russian operative. You've just got it. But it turns out communism is just a red herring the whole time.
It's been a red herring the entire time.
Red-haired herring.
Red scaring. Yeah, there's a lot of different, you know, moments like that throughout the season where it does feel like it's like building up to something else, but then it ends up being like fairly domestic or just like, you know, interpersonal weaknesses or strengths. Like with Bob, he's not really a traitor or some sort of double agent. He's just Bob Newby superhero. Max is just Max. Mad Max, but just Max. And I don't really know.
Billy is an abuse victim. Takes out that abuse on other people and bullies them.
Yeah, bullies them.
Billy's them. Yeah, I didn't love that story. I don't mind the introduction of Max. I think she's great. And I think the dynamics that changed the group with the introduction of that character are great. And I think that she was really cool to see. Just everything about that character, I think, worked really well, except for this stuff with Billy. It just felt so, like, when he's trying to run the kids down on his bike, like, this kid is a sociopath. Like, he's beyond, like, even 80s high school bully, even though I think that's what they were going for. Like, he's really just the worst.
Power bully.
Yeah, the fight with Steve is pretty good, though.
Fight with Steve's pretty good. Billy and Mrs. Wheeler is fantastic.
Yeah, like I said, that's hilarious. I mean, the guy from the cover of the romance novel that she's reading in her bathtub with
shows
her
up.
ever-present glass of wine just rings her doorbell. Yeah, that's fantastic. That was really funny.
My colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Dan Feinberg, had a question for me to ask to the Duffers that I was not able to get to, but I posed the question to you just for the sake of conversation. Does Billy have Steve Harrington upside, where Steve Harrington is the character who throughout much of season one is kind of the clown? You know, he's the jerk. He's the guy who just like outright outright sucks. And by the end of the season, you like Steve Harrington. He's come to the right side of things. He's helping to fight the Demogorgon and goes on to have a really, really fun, one of the best storylines of season two by far. Is there anything like that in Billy's future? Do you expect, or is Billy just going to be out and out bad? Could you even imagine the scenario where he's completely kicked for season three? Do you think that Billy has that potential to be somebody that fans can make a turnaround on moving forward?
That's certainly an interesting question. I think that the depths to which Billy sunk in this season were much deeper than anything Steve ever did. He's physically abusive to Max. He's trying to kill the kids. Like, he's not concerned about what might happen if he's doing those things. He is a much more deplorable person than Steve ever was. Even though Steve had some major problems, this is nothing like that. This is a physically abusive, bad, bad dude. He almost beat Steve to death. And if not for Max injecting him with that the sedative, he would have died. I think he would have killed Steve. I don't think he would have stopped. I mean, I don't think we had any indication that he was planning on stopping. So I think that you'd have to go something. He'd have to do, it would have to be a very significant hero turn, even though we got a little nuance with the character when we see that he's an abuse victim himself. Even though I think he really, at this point, could have taken his dad. Like, I really think he just needs to throw down with that dude, and I think he could beat the crap out of him. But I think that we got the nuance, but I just don't know what you could possibly do to turn that guy and give him upside, considering how awful they made him. That said, what I thought the end for that character was going to be was a glorious, glorious death. I thought the Demodogs were just going to rip him limb from limb, and we were actually going to cheer for it. And I couldn't believe that we didn't get that in this season. I thought a glorious death was coming for that character.
Yeah, maybe season three. Maybe season three, and that'll be the redemption. It's just some sort of epic Billy death.
Yeah, I just don't know how you redeem the things that he's done. I mean, short of like just direct, like, I don't even, he's literally abused characters that we care about on screen in a very physical and ongoing way. I don't know that's not the same as like being a bad boyfriend or being a jerk as a boyfriend and being able to apologize for that directly and say, I was really stupid and I did some dumb things and try to immediately make up for it. Like we saw with Steve, Billy is an abuser, and I don't know how you remedy that without him saying, let's go to therapy and I want to fix this. And even then, I feel icky about it. So I don't think that it's possible.
I'm going to plant the flag on a prediction. I hate to will it into existence. I think Steve Harrington will Farrah Fawcett his hair one final time in season three.
You think he's dead?
Yeah, I'm in season three. I'm making the call. I think justice for Steve. I think Steve, not justice for Billy, of course, but justice for Steve. I think that, like, because you're trying to figure out like how to figure him back into the story. If he goes off to college, you can imagine the scenario. He comes home for the holidays, but like, what's his like continued involvement in the story of Stranger Things moving forward? Like, what is his tie? Does he just become so close with Dustin that like he's just like basically Dustin's brother from here on out, and so that's why he's going to be part of the action? He's not dating Nancy anymore, so like, what really draws him into things? So eventually you're going to have to answer that question or figure out a way to resolve Steve Harrington. And I think that the hot take would be like Steve Harrington is the Han Solo of Stranger Things, and like you can imagine some sort of frozen in carbonite type of moment for him coming up down the pike where he's able to sacrifice himself for some sort of greater cause for the rest of the people who are fighting the Demogorgons and fighting off the Mind Flayer and whatever else comes from the Upside Down. I could just see that happening, like one last stand with his nail bat. I think would be really great. I don't know if there's like an I love you, I know to get out of that, but I feel like one final stand for Steve Harrington is something that I'm calling for season three.
Yeah, I like that. And he still looks longingly at Nancy, but he also looks longingly at Nancy with the idea that I need to be better than that. I need to not be concerned about it or be worried about it. I can't fixate on it. Take the same advice that he's giving Dustin and not care.
It's great. Isn't that so great where he's like, he's clearly heartbroken, but not heartbroken with an eye of like, I'll do anything to get back together. Right. It's like, this didn't work. I'm starting to understand why it didn't work. Jonathan's a decent dude, so I hope you guys are happy. I just kind of have to move on, and I clearly have my own stuff that I'm working on internally. And like, if the journey for that is some sort of self-sacrifice on top of all of that, I think it's a good story. But even without that, I think the story of Steve was really great. Not what you normally get out of like that kind of like teenage angst storyline. So I was really appreciative of that. Like, Steve Harrington has constantly been such a subversive character throughout Stranger Things. They always do a great job with that character.
Yeah, and then now they'll probably kill him. You're probably
That's
right.
That's why I think it'd be good, though. I think it could be good.
Yeah, I think you're probably right in that respect. How about another character that we didn't talk about? What about I really thought that this was an underrated part of the season, and I don't know if you know anything more about Erica Sinclair, Josh, Lucas's sister.
So good. So great.
So funny. So perfect little sister role.
Yeah, I mean, like, not much to say other than, like, when she's, like, hanging up on Dustin and just, like, giving Lucas so much crap. Like, she was just terrific. Like, I don't know what the increased role for her would be moving forward. I would love to see both Erica and Holly Wheeler, both, like, have enhanced roles moving forward. Holly did not have anything to do in season two, which made me sad because she was so hilarious in the first season. But I would love to see, like, the youngest siblings being drawn into the action more. I think would be hilarious moving forward. And Erica was just she was spectacular. She was great.
Yeah, I really like seeing more of the Sinclair family, but specifically Erica. And just that's a perfect, again, that has nothing really to do with action or with the ultimate story. It's more of your 80s movie or your teen movie cliche of having the younger sibling just breaking balls, just literally just undermining or just taking the air out of every cool thing that you try to do. And I thought she performed that role fantastically. And that has very little to do with demo dogs or anything like that. So I think more stuff like that is smart. I think that was a really smart thing to do with Lucas, because Lucas is trying to seem so cool and repeat his line in the mirror over and over again and have that the wind taken right out of his sails by his little sister is great. So more of that. I'm all on board. Anything else from this season, the new stuff that what about Barb's parents? Did you think that was well cast, and did you laugh at the KFC, the product placement scene, Josh?
I thought that was fine. I thought it was fine.
Did it bother you when Steve's like, oh, this is finger licking good? It's like, oh, I wonder who paid for this.
A little bit. Though I do, you know, I'm not here to turn my nose up at KFC. You know, I'm not a monster here. You know.
Do they have McFried chicken pizza? Is that something you've ever eaten?
I'm sure I've had it somewhere along the way. You know. It all blends together after a while. No, I don't think I have really any other major hot takes. I mean, this is just kind of a broad conversation about season two of Stranger Things. Like we said at the top, go to Jay and Jack, check them out for the more granular focus on the season episode by episode. But I really liked season two of Stranger Things. I loved season one. I did not love season two. Season two had a lot more misses than season one had, I think, and some really big ones for me that, you know, it'll be hard to really, I don't know about correcting those. I mean, those whiffs exist. You know, chapter 7 is going to be a whiff for me pretty much no matter what moving forward. So there were just a few things this season that I did not love and did not respond to very well. But then there were the things that were really tremendously great. Like, everything Steve Harrington was fantastic. Steve and Dustin was fantastic. Eleven and Hopper as a combo. Really, really great. Noah Schnapp. I really can't say enough how awesome I thought everything going on with Will was. So there were definitely great aspects of season 2. I just think it was a little bit of a weaker effort from season one. And I'm really excited about season three because it's not an entirely blank canvas. There are characters in the mix. There's a town in the mix. There is a shadow dimension in the mix. All of those are ingredients that must be played with moving forward. But exactly how they're going to be played with, I think it's a lot harder to predict than season one going into season two. So that's exciting for me. Can't wait to see how that all shakes out. In terms of specific moments from season two that we didn't really talk about, I'm pretty good. Anything that really stands out to you?
No, but if you take it into 1985 with season three, then what you're looking at from a pop culture standpoint, Back to the Future, the actual movie The Goonies, Josh.
Yes.
But also The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Rambo, Cocoon. So there are some big things that could influence the story indirectly in terms of what they're going for, but also directly in terms of what the story we might see. I mean, that's also the year of Mad Max, Beyond Thunderdome, Teen Wolf, Josh, if we're going with the Steve Harrington bat. basketball story, and maybe Billy is secretly a werewolf. I don't know. There are a lot of things that they could pull from, with 1985 specifically being an influence that could impact the story. So I'm looking forward to seeing ultimately if you're talking about this was an Aliens season, maybe we bring in more of the alien influence, and maybe the Upside Down has more to do with an otherworldly or extraterrestrial influence. That's something that was big in the 80s for sure. I don't know. The fact that The Breakfast Club is a 1985 movie, there's a lot of potential there for me. I still think that there's a potential to make this show less in the action movie realm throughout. I don't think that's what they'll do, but the more that they can do the snowball type scenes, I think the more people love those scenes because we love the characters so much. And I think you could put these characters in any number of scenarios and it would work really well.
Yeah, totally agreed. Anything else before we sign off here, Antonio?
No, if this is the first time you've heard anything that we do here at Post Show Recaps, we podcast about TV shows, sometimes the occasional movies. We do a lot of one-to-one every episode podcasts where we do episodic podcasts. Josh, you and I right now are talking about USA's Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot, yes. Mr. Robot is happening weekly on Wednesday nights on USA Network, and Antonio and I are getting together for Friday podcasts where we are doing mega deep dives into every episode of Mr. Robot as it airs. So check that out, postshowrecaps.com/robot. We're also podcasting about The Walking Dead over here. Rob Cesternino and Jessica Lease are tackling the Sunday night shows right after each new episode. And then Rob and I are taking your feedback on Wednesdays for our Wednesday shows. We also have Game of Thrones podcasts are ongoing here on Post Show Recaps. We are doing a weekly rewatch of the whole series of Game of Thrones with both a spoiler-free and spoiler-filled perspective. So that's a real fun podcast, I think, that you guys got a kick out of. Rob and Akiva Winokur are talking about Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is also happening on very busy Sunday nights, Star Trek Discovery Sunday nights as well, and Rob has been tackling that show. Anything else that I'm missing? I think that's really, we got our hands full right now.
We have our hands very full. We do a lot of stuff here at Post Show Recap. So you can always go to, what's the link, Josh? PostShowRecaps.com/iTunes.
That would be the one. That would be the best way. You can subscribe there. Leave your ratings and your reviews. We would appreciate them very, very much. Antonio, you are on the Twitter bots. How do they find you? What is the way? What is the way to do that?
I'm at AC Moderato. No, AC Mazzaro with two Z's and one R.
And I am at Round Howard. So hit us up with your Stranger Things thoughts. Curious for your takes on the season. Thank you guys for listening. And we will see you in an Upside Down universe in about a year, if not sooner. Bye.
Goodbye.